You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Kasper Tokuwingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for the 18th of October. My name is Kasper, I'm one of your hosts for today, and I'm joined by Christina. Kine, coming up on the show today.
Joel Rindelov is joining us here in studio to talk science news, including some cool bird content for our Dear Science segment. Casper spoke to Dr. Shane Areti from the National Party for their weekly segment. Casper also spoke to Morgan Theakston from Tier Fund about their annual ethical fashion report. I'm also speaking to Dr. Lena Lee from the University of Auckland about the impacts of having female directors on company boards, and Lisa McEwen from AUT about Tier Fund's ethical fashion report.
Hey, Ofakado, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces or just whatever's on your mind, so tuku patui mai. You can text us on 5395 Waiamairane or give us a call in the studio on 309 3879.
Also, after the show, koe e ware ware e aheana koutou te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō, he pakihiri rukiruki maronga i te paitukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM, irekari.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. But enough admin, you're probably frothing for Dear Science, so let's get into it.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, Joel. How are we doing today?
Kia ora. I am awesome. And you know why? Bird of the Year voting has opened.
That's right. So, you know, don't forget about that, because this is an important part of our democracy. I know we put out a lot of warnings for the local body elections, but this is serious here.
This is what actually matters. So I got to ask, who are you backing this year?
Well, here at the station, our official stance is the karere, which is a falcon, and apparently cannibalistic, which we've been
Ooh.
Told. I don't know how accurate that is, but we do have a station duty to say that. Just a disclaimer.
Well, I'm going to tell you who I'm backing this year, and that is the Kuaka.
The Kuaka.
The Kuaka, also known as the Godwit, who has the longest flight of any bird in the world, travels from Alaska to New Zealand every year. Longest flight has been over 8 days. No stopping for food, no stopping for sleep, no stopping for anything.
God.
The Kuaka.
I don't know if I've ever done anything for 8 days in a row.
I mean, you probably lived.
Lived, yeah, the bare minimum. But yeah. not making it a journey for 8 days straight without stopping.
Although sometimes it feels like it. All right, let's talk about some science here. We got, now that we're all excited about Bird of the Year, let's talk about birdsong. There was a recent paper where they actually just let people listen to birdsong for 6 minutes versus listening to urban traffic setting, and found that listening to birdsong is good for the old noggin. Improvements in anxiety and paranoia after listening to just 6 minutes of birds doing their thing versus people that are listening to urban traffic actually showed more signs of depression.
I guess living in town, having to listen to cars beeping at each other can't be good for you.
No, probably a little stressful.
I wonder if that would change if we knew what the birds were saying.
Yes. Yes. What do birds say? We don't exactly know. But
crazy.
That's a whole nother Dear Science topic. But the idea is that nature is good for us, because there was also another study that came out recently that said that people that spend an hour just walking in nature versus an hour walking in an urban area had less stress and fear. And so this time, they're able to do an MRI on these people's brains before and after and saw that their amygdala, which is the part of the brain that controls stress and fear. So climbers, people that do free solo, Alex Holland, if you've ever seen that movie Free Solo, his amygdala actually doesn't activate at all, meaning that quantifiably he does not have fear.
Well, that would explain a lot.
Right. But again, another Dear Science topic. That was the part of the brain that they were actually looking at in this study and found that people that were spent an hour just walking out in nature, less activation of the amygdala, meaning less stress and fear.
Do we know if this would work with like fake birdsong? So could we replace like, you know, the cars honking noises with, you know, some bird cry?
In theory, yes. So that's what they did, is they actually had a CD, played it for 6 minutes, doesn't matter where you are, but just what they're proposing is the exposure to this nature sound, and birds, gotta love our birds, is what's doing the trick here.
I feel like some, just the general ambiance, if you will, of birds just singing is quite nice, but also like, this might not apply to all birds. Like if one was just shrieking by your ear, like if you heard a magpie.
True. I've been to Australia. It's terrible there.
They're like just dive bombing you. I can't imagine that is anxiety relieving.
Right. There could be a lot of different confounding factors and biases in this study. But the idea is, along with this nature walk study, is that it appears green is good.
It is. It's good to have some actual science backing that up, rather than just someone saying, "Hey, go for a walk."
Right. More research is needed. So, anyone thinking about taking any walks this summer, some hikes in the bush, science has your back.
Wow. There you go.
All right. Well, let's talk some more brain stuff, because we're getting into the brains here, and some researchers in Australia in a completely different study have done something a bit funky. Now, are either of you gamers?
No.
No, I don't think so.
No, neither of us will admit it on air, but we're here and our official stance is no.
Okay. Are you familiar with the game Pong?
Yes.
Yes, where you have the two sides and the ball bounces back and forth. You'd basically try to score
it. It's really hard.
It's...
maybe for you.
It's a game, all right. Well, anyway, what scientists did is they got real nerdy and they wanted to play some Pong, so they grew a brain in a lab, like in a dish, and taught it to play Pong.
Stop it. Okay, what are the logistics here? I have so many questions.
Was that the first thing they taught it to do?
Well, they wanted to test how well it could react to external stimuli.
Right.
So it's the first time they've ever been able to connect it to something like that. And they said, well, why not Pong? It's simple, straightforward. We can see if we can teach it to play, and it learned the game within 5 minutes.
Wow. Was it good?
No, it was awful. But better than random chance.
Right.
So there's still room for improvement, but it was a step forward.
I feel like you probably benefit from having arms as opposed to just being a brain in a dish, but this is really interesting.
Right. So it was basically just giving it electrical signals at different frequencies, because that's what your brain is. It's a connection of neurons, and they're firing different electrical signals. So they were able to manipulate that and actually have this tiny brain. So it's not like a full brain. This is something that is like the size of a bumblebee, maybe.
Right.
But they're able to connect it to these electrodes, and the way that it worked is that if it missed the ball in Pong, it would give it a random signal. And biologically, we don't like randomness. We want things that are predictable. So every time it made a save, it gave it a predictable response, and it found that it would eventually make enough moves to get that predictable response.
Oh my gosh.
So do we have any idea of what they could do next? Given, you know, if this is successful, where do you go from here?
So the researchers, the first thing they're going to do once they make this brain is they're going to get it drunk. You think I'm joking?
All that stress from playing Pong.
Yeah. So they're going to give it alcohol and see how that impairs how the brain works. So what they're trying to do is to create something where you can actually like test drugs and see how they work without, you know, doing animal studies, or something that is like an organoid like a human brain, so they might get better treatments out of it.
Got a bit of feedback there.
Sorry, that sounds horrendous. But yeah, well, I guess getting a brain drunk as opposed to just getting teenagers drunk or your typical uni students would probably be a better option.
That is the concept, yes. And it is really interesting. Now, we're not talking about a fully sentient brain that knows it's a brain yet. So there are obviously ethical questions that need to be addressed before you go and start making what is our intelligence in the lab, but we're getting places when it comes to science, always pushing the boundaries.
Yeah, and maybe the brain will enjoy a bit of vodka as opposed to tequila. Guess that's
a completely different study, Christina. Again, we'll try to stay on topic here. All right, one final amazing story that I know you're going to appreciate. Mm. And this time we're talking about an archaeological mystery dealing with frogs.
But no longer a mystery. Is that the case?
Well, not really. See, we have some good evidence to suggest that this mystery has been solved. So we're talking frogs here. Frogs, if you didn't know, are actually pretty cool. They've been around since dinosaurs. They lived beside dinosaurs.
Oh my God. I didn't expect them to be from millions of years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know why I thought they were just kind of there.
So what this archaeological study looked at was, or this paleontology, excuse me, is that they looked at 45 million years ago. They had this big, huge mass death of frogs, and they had no idea why. They thought, well, maybe it's because they lived in this pond and the pond dried up, or maybe, well, there's disease or something. And these researchers recently found out it's neither of those.
No way, it was an asteroid.
They are proposing that it was a mass frog orgy that went wrong.
Wow.
If you've been following along in recent weeks, we've had some talk about orgies in terms of dolphins. And this was kind of like a smaller group, but not how mass are we talking here?
So this was, I think they had about 150 specimens. And so what they've actually been able to see these in different locations are these mass graves. And so what they're proposing is that these frogs were getting a little too freaky and they just lost energy to exhaustion and they drowned in the pond.
You would think a mass orgy would be good for the survival of a species, right?
You would think, but there's a limit apparently on exactly how much orgy you can do if you're a frog.
Sorry, so you could graph this limit of the physical exertion versus biological benefits.
Correct.
And they have gone past this point.
The point of no return.
They were just far too tired.
And yeah. For those taking notes at home on Dear Science health advice, we've got, obviously, go for a walk in the park and listen to the birds and don't, you know, let your orgies get out of bounds, right?
Correct. These are the tenets of this radio program.
And let's kind of go back to the study and how they kind of came to this conclusion. I doubt they used orgy in this scientific report at all.
Mating. Excessive mating.
Oh. And so, yeah, how did they kind of come to this conclusion?
So they looked at the actual fossilized pieces of frog themselves. They found that some of the smaller bones weren't there, which means that they were probably floated away or something. So that means, okay, the pond was still there. They were well preserved. If there wasn't a pond there, if they were just exposed to the atmosphere, they would have decayed way faster. So they're like, all right, the pond was still there. We don't see any evidence for disease, and we know that this can happen with frog and toad species because they live on land, but they go back to these ponds and lakes to mate because they got to create those tadpoles, and this is where things can take a dire turn.
But why might it be that this happened as like a one-off event or, you know, over a certain period of time and doesn't like continue on?
The thing is, they don't believe it is a one-off event. That this is explaining a lot of the mass graves that they are seeing for these different types of species.
Man, animals can get real freaky. That's
by design.
By design. So, yeah.
Wow, again, fantastic.
Take notes at home. There is a limit, an upper bound to the amount of mass animal sex you can have.
Always learning so much here on Dare Science. Thank you, Joel.
Always a pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was Dear Science with Joel Rindelob. Keep us company and keep sending those texts in. The number is 5395. Stay tuned.
MOTAT's all set to blow with Nga Meru Meru Bubbles.
days of hands-on fun and learning.
Catch a bubble, paint with bubbles, even get inside a giant bubble.
With little flick rides, food trucks, rainbow rascals and more, it's fun for the whole whānau.
Ngā meru meru bubbles.
Labour Weekend, October 22nd, 23rd and 24th, 10 to 4pm at MOTAT.
Find out more at motat.nz.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Why? Wait, how does it go?
BFM News.
Although this morning's CPI numbers show that inflation may have peaked, the cost of food continues to be disproportionately high. Statistics New Zealand is telling us that the increase to food prices is the highest it's been in 13 years at 8.3%. For my weekly catch-up with the National Party's Dr. Shane Retty, we spoke about the issue of food inflation as well as last week's He Waka Eke Noa announcement. I first asked Shane where this inflation is coming from and why it's so concerning for food prices in particular.
So what we know from the data last week is that over the past year, average food prices have gone up by about 8% and almost double that for fruit and vegetables. And that's making it really hard for New Zealanders to basically put food on their table. The policy settings are really challenging. We're hearing from constituents regularly saying, Shane, I'm paying $10 for a cabbage. Is that for real? When did we start doing that? And if we look at some of the causes to that, there are policy settings that have some influence, and one of the key ones is the labour shortage, the widespread labour shortages that we have and bottlenecks in the economy that are arising from failed immigration settings. And this is passing through into domestic inflation, which we have some control of. This is not offshore fuel-related inflation. This is domestic inflation. And so some of the policy settings that we have are contributing to these very high food prices.
So what is your plan to address these settings to make sure that New Zealanders can all afford to eat, and especially eat healthily?
So we've said two things. First of all, we would index the tax brackets to inflation, giving New Zealanders more money in their pockets, more disposable income. And then secondly, we've been very clear on the immigration settings, that we would base the immigration settings on need, critical industries. We would relax the immigration settings. I mean, obviously in health, it's not food related, but we would position internationally qualified nurses into a day one pathway to residency. Very late in the piece for RSD workers to be expanded. We'd have done that a lot sooner, pleased to see it happen, but that's a direct immigration setting relationship to food production, those RSD workers that pick fruit and aid the horticultural industry.
Some amount of the blame seems to often get directed towards the major supermarkets. Do you believe that the lack of competition for Foodstuffs and Woolworths is behind any amount of this inflation? And if so, how might this be addressed?
So the Commerce Commission inquiry into supermarket monopolies, was the question they were raising, did suggest that it is a monopoly and not healthy for competition. And so I was pleased to see some of the suggestions which they have brought forward. So as far as we can determine a contributor, probably a small contributor compared to workforce shortages, but a contributor that's being addressed by the Commerce Commission.
Do you believe that more assistance needs to be given to low-income New Zealanders in particular to ensure that they can afford the kinds of foods necessary for a balanced diet?
So this is what changing or indexing the tax brackets would do. It would give New Zealanders more disposable income where they could make healthier food choices. And so to answer your question, yes, well, whatever we need to do for the most vulnerable so that they can have food choices and healthy food choices, those are the sort of policy settings we're interested in.
The National Party has announced its opposition to their Hei Waka Eke Noa announcement around the reduction of agricultural emissions. Exactly what parts of this plan do you see to be problematic and why?
So we're concerned, first of all, we're broadly supportive of the carbon zero target. We have been for a while, but we're concerned that Hei Waka Eke Noa, as it was announced last week, will have a significant impact on sheep and beef farming particularly, potentially reducing them by a fifth over 5 years. So we're concerned with the mechanisms towards that goal, and that's where our opposition springs from.
How do you believe the plan might affect the current cost of living crisis in New Zealand?
Look, our sense is that if we're going to reduce sheep and beef farming, that first of all, potentially less income into local economies, and that secondly, less income from export dollars. If that is the case, all of that would make the cost of living more expensive. So there could indeed be a flow-through effect to rural communities and to wider New Zealand by the proposals in Hei Waka Eke Noa.
How committed to reducing agricultural emissions is the National Party, and how would you go about achieving this as an alternative to what was announced?
So absolutely committed. We have been from day one on our responsibilities that we understand for climate change. What we do believe is that those who are in the industry are best placed to advise and help us collaborate with central government towards the goals we all want to achieve. Farmers want to achieve the same goals that we do. It's just how we get there that is different. And we strongly believe that we should be placing significant voice on those who are actually in the sector and collaborate more effectively than Hei Waka Eke Noa has towards the mechanism that will achieve our climate ambitions.
Do you have any sense of what such a mechanism might look like in such a way that it wouldn't reduce agricultural output by a fifth, as you say the current plan might?
So what we've heard from farmers is that if there's a longer transition period and if we invest heavily into technology, that there are mechanisms there where we can progress towards the climate emission goals. So those are two policy settings that we'd be looking at. What is a transition period? Is it a reasonable time frame to achieve those objectives? And exactly what is required in research and development and technology to give farmers the tools to achieve those goals? The agricultural and horticultural sector are disappointed with, that is that some of the tree planting, riparian, etc., that they do hedgerows, for example, that are on farms, are not taken into account as carbon sequesters. And so this is something that we think should be taken into account as well.
That was National MP Dr. Shane Retty talking about high food prices and the Hiawatha Ekanoa agricultural emissions reduction.
A new study has found that having female directors on the board of a socially responsible company can have a moderating effect. Socially responsible companies benefit from having more women on their boards, but on the flip side, any negative press involving social irresponsibility will result in the company value tanking more if there are women on the board. I spoke to one of the researchers, Dr. Lena Lee from the University of Auckland, about this study and what it means for businesses. One key finding of this study was having women on boards or greater gender diversity improved the overall positive effect of companies that are already socially responsible. Could you talk us through this finding?
Yeah, so we already know that positive CSR-related activities have the helps to enhance firm value, and negative CSR activities destroy firm value, and also board gender diversity in general helps to improve firm value. But that picture wasn't still very clear in terms of the evidence that was in the literature. So what we did was look at how gender diversity on the boards helped to, whether that moderate or changes the relation between CSR activities and firm value.
Mm.
Right. So one main finding that you mentioned is that with the positive side of things is when there's more women on board, positive CSR-related activities help to enhance firm value even more compared to when there's only male directors on the board. But we also find that, when there's negative CSR activities at the firm and when there's female directors on the board, that negative impact on firm value is actually enhanced, exacerbated. So that's kind of two findings that we found. So if we look at a firm's CSR performance as a whole, so after taking account of their positive activities and negative activities, having more female directors on the board still helps to improve the value duration from their CSR performance in general.
As an example, I guess, if a company was engaging in pollution despite positing itself as a very environmentally conscious, eco-friendly brand, having more women on these boards would make the firm value drop more. Is that correct?
Yes, that's interpretation of the findings. Because once investors find out about their wrongdoings in the social and environmental area, because having women on board kind of signals that the firm commits to diversity, which is one dimension of good being a good corporate citizen. And firms that engage, that have male directors on the board generally perform well in CSR activities. So when bad news happen, negative events happen, that negative effect on firm value is even more. So your understanding is correct, yes.
Moving forward from this research, what is kind of the best way for boards to use this information? Because obviously if you have more women on the boards and you are socially responsible, then your firm value will go up more. But if you have women on the board and things go wrong, then it will plummet. What can businesses take from this?
Yeah, I guess, a main takeaway is that women are can better take care of their company's CSR-related activities and initiatives, because, you know, the argument is that the findings from prior research is that, you know, women, they are more community-minded, they are better at building stakeholder relationships, those kind of things. Yeah, so if a firm is committed to be a good corporate citizen, be active in the CSR space, then it would be helpful for them to have more female directors on the board, because that's what our findings show that would translate to greater firm value. Yeah, but if a firm just want to greenwash or look good, but you know, does not really do good in the social and environmental space, then having a kind of a display of gender diversity is not going to help them help their firm value in the long run, at least as perceived by the investors. Yeah, because when we looked at financial performance as measured by an accounting measure, for having directors on the board does not hurt the financial accounting performance of a firm arising from, you know, CSR controversies, negative CSR activities. So it's only the investor perceived firm value that gets affected more when bad news happens, when negative events happen.
Could this kind of data be extrapolated to any businesses that don't portray themselves as, you know, eco-friendly, socially responsible? If this is kind of a business that doesn't really have much public interest in doing things like this, is there any impact of gender diversity on those boards and how investors see those companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, every study has its limitations, right? We sampled from a large S&P 1,500 US firms, so on a large size. So if a firm, I'd say if they voluntarily appoint female directors on the board, that means they probably, you know, expect to realize some value from that. So I'm not sure if there's a law that requires all the firms to have at least some female directors on the board, it would be interesting to investigate if subsequently that has an effect on how their CSR activities affect firm value from that point onwards, from when they have more female directors on the board. Yeah, so that's still worthy of further investigation.
It is quite interesting because obviously, yeah, if you're forced to appoint women, that could be seen as tokenistic and kind of appeasing to the law, for example, or just increasing pressure to have gender diversity on the boards. So, yeah, the study kind of looks at more people who choose to take these steps, right?
Yes. Yeah, if you're interested, there's actually another paper, not from me, but from another team of researchers. They looked at, there's a mandate of gender diversity, board gender quotas in California, and they find that, you know, by forcing firms to have more female directors on the board, actually investors reacted negatively to that.
That was Dr. Lena Lee from the University of Auckland Business School speaking to me about a study looking into the effect of having female directors on the board of a company.
The 2022 Ethical Fashion Report by Tear Fund. Apologies, we'll go just quickly to a couple of songs now and then we'll be back for some more news followed by a short report.
Beastie, quiet little beastie, you have to be stealth to stay in the game. Beastie, they don't make them like they used to. Last chance for anywhere, it's recon day. Show looks different on the outside, chasing that green on the other side. Is that us? Is that us? Is that us?
don't wanna have to rein you in now. You leave me no choice. You got no pride. Out here, it's anybody's game. Even if it's stitched at the starting line. Sure looks different on the outside. Chasing that green on the other side. Is that us? Is that us? Is that us? Is that us? Two arrows, honey and poison. We got drunk on the news. We were winning. Nothing tastes sweeter, it's all liquor, liquor. Eyes were shut, fill my cup and quicker, quicker. I know we hurt you. Love stings and heals, it's in the embers. Where the fire's revealed if you say nothing, nothing at all. Nothing comes to light. Is that all?
Festival is just around the corner with over 30 acts of big time musical goodness.
Featuring Anthony Tonin, The Coolies, Shafu and the Crates, Dance Exponents, Earth Tongue, Laura Jean, Mind Design and the Rare Pleasures, Pneumatics, Nadia Reid, Steve Gunn, Swidit, Te Kahu, and so much more.
95BFM presents The Other's Way this Saturday all along Kay Road. Don't miss out. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar and flyingout.co.nz.
Lost from the start, and now the lost light is here, and everyone's asleep. Hey, I'm Paddy Gower, and this is f***ing BFM.
The 2022 Ethical Fashion Report by Tear Fund has been released and shows low standards overall in labour practices and sustainable production. Footwear companies scored particularly poorly, with the Nahuia Group, which trades as Hannah and Number One Shoes, getting a zero on the report. This morning, they put out a press release blaming the challenges of COVID for their refusal to take part. I spoke to Morgan Theakston, advocacy specialist at Tear Fund, about the report, what it means, and what consumers can take away from it. I began by asking her what the report is and what exactly it measures.
Yeah, so the Ethical Fashion Report is a tool to provide insight into the fashion industry. And it measures companies' efforts to address the risks of worker exploitation in their supply chains and to reduce their impact on the environment.
We're seeing in this latest report that footwear companies performed below the industry average. Was this something that could have been expected, and what might the causes be?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been researching the fashion industry, particularly clothing companies, for the past 6 years, and we've seen really positive change, but we feel that footwear companies have really slipped under the radar and haven't been scrutinized in the same way in New Zealand and globally. And so the average footwear score is a 23%, and it is low. Most companies scored very low. And we're not surprised by this because, as I mentioned, the same pressure hasn't been applied. It wasn't really a surprise to us that shoe companies are lagging behind clothing companies.
Are there any areas that seem to be doing better than expected? Where are the most promising improvements happening?
I think that we've seen more promising improvements around sustainability initiatives, so using sustainable fibers, making a climate commitment. Only one-fifth of companies made a commitment to reduce emissions in their supply chain, so it's still not great, but we're seeing just better results there than around things involving workers like living wages and monitoring and tracing supply chains, so knowing where their shoes are being made.
This particularly low score for footwear companies, is this mostly coming out of their labor practices or sustainability? What kind of sector is this?
To be honest, it's both. So all are scoring low. But we do see some companies like Allbirds who still scored just above the average at around a 27%. We see companies like them scoring low because while they have really great sustainability initiatives using, New Zealand merino wool, they don't have much information available on what's happening in their factories across Asia, on if they're paying a living wage. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of companies score low that may, have actually great reputations in sustainability. It's because they're not being open and honest about what's going on with their workers and in their factories.
Do you think that the impacts of COVID constitute a valid excuse for lagging behind in ethical trading practices or even not reporting on their practices?
I would say absolutely not. Mostly because, of course COVID has had major impacts in places like New Zealand, but the countries where workers live that are making our shoes don't have the same safety nets as New Zealand does. We saw many workers showing up to work and being fired on the spot and refused their legally owed severance pay, had their wages withheld. We saw, workers being pushed into literal starvation, people having, garment workers having to sell their bodies because they're not able to make a wage anymore. And so, it's so bad there that if there's any time where companies should be ensuring that workers' rights are being upheld, that workers are still being paid wages for a lot of times the orders they've already completed, then it's during a time like COVID and during a pandemic when people are more vulnerable to exploitation.
Is there a high correlation between more sustainable practices and more sort of domestic labor and domestic products being used?
Most companies that we assess, these bigger companies, don't make their shoes in New Zealand. It's a very small market here we don't really have the level of skilled labor here to make shoes or the quantity of people that know how to do it anymore. And I think that we do see, though, companies, if a company is using organic cotton, that inherently means that it's better for workers and the planet because, workers aren't using these pesticides that are extremely toxic. Or if we see companies using vegetable tanned leather as opposed to chromium, which is a really toxic chemical, chromium tanned leather, then, workers are no longer having these skin diseases or increased rates of cancers. So of course, we do see kind of those correlations when it comes to sustainability. But, we still need to see, as we say, Real sustainability has to include sustainable wages for the people who make our shoes. Sustainability and, you know, social well-being, they go hand in hand.
What does this report tell us about how New Zealanders might need to change our approach to consumption?
So the longer we work in this space, we realize that at the crux of so many of the issues around people and planet is the increasing rates of overproduction, so companies making too many shoes, and overconsumption, so us buying too many shoes. You know, we see things like sneaker culture and, you know, fast fashion and the way that we consume and treat shoes as disposable when trends change. And so the report, our biggest message this year in our report and our article, actually, is for people to buy less. So really think about, like, when you're going out to the shops, do I actually need this or do I have something in my closet that I can wear? We encourage people to repair rather than replace. And then we encourage people, you know, if you buy less, then you may be in a better position to invest in quality, which will last longer. And we're really encouraging people to live by the five R's, which we say reduce, rewear, repair, rehome, and raise your voice and tell companies what you expect from them.
Do you believe that it's very important that people, I guess, go to particularly sustainable companies or producers that have scored well? Or is more of the emphasis just on, as you say, these sort of practices of consumption rather than where exactly you're consuming from?
I would say I encourage people to think about the consumption habits first and foremost. In terms of go to the companies that are scoring well, right, nobody's scoring well. So, I mean, we're not putting out an article saying, choose from the brands that are the highest scoring. That's not our messaging this year. We're purely saying, here's how brands responded to our 46-question survey. Here's our research results. I'd say the number one message is think about your consumption. Buy less. And I would really encourage people to choose secondhand. I really believe that you can't actually shop your way to a sustainable shoe collection or wardrobe. It's one that you already have, and it's extending the life of other shoes as well by going pre-loved.
That was Morgan Thigston from Tearfund speaking about their annual ethical fashion report, which Christina is just about to follow up on.
As mentioned earlier, the Ngā Huia group declined to participate in this study. In a press release this morning, they said, quote, "It has been extremely challenging for our team, suppliers and customers as we navigated the ever-changing impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. During this period, we prioritised our team and suppliers to ensure the best outcome, which allowed us to continue providing a service to our customers. Participating in such reports takes significant time and resource for our internal team and that of our supply partners." End quote. In their statement, the Ngā Huia group strongly denied engaging in modern slavery and reiterated their support for sustainable practices and have pledged to publicly communicate their sustainability statement and supply chain practices going forward. I also spoke to Lisa McEwen, a fashion and sustainability expert from AUT. She was unavailable for an interview but sent me her analysis. She says there are lots of positive aspects of the annual Tearfund report. She said it was admirable that the organisation is asking brands to report on their supply chains, and this undoubtedly puts pressure on them to ensure their supply chains are ethical. However, because most of their data is gained from self-reporting by the brands, this raises the question as to whether brands with better scores simply have better marketing teams. The other concern McEwen has is self-reporting on environmental sustainability. In previous years, a brand that deals exclusively with wool was afforded an A+ ranking, and while wool is a natural fibre, sheep farming comes with significant biogenic methane emissions, as do cows, putting a significant question mark on the environmental sustainability of wool and leather. In Aotearoa, sheep and cows are responsible for 44% of our greenhouse gas emissions in the form of methane and nitrous oxide. McEwen says that to Tearfund's credit, the charity states that the most ethical and sustainable wardrobe is the one you already own. They said that the best thing you can do for people and the planet is to stop the demand for overproduction by buying less. And that was Lisa McEwen, a fashion and sustainability lecturer from AUT.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Your way's Joel Rindelorb, National's Dr. Shane Retty, Dr. Lena Lee, Morgan Thigston from Tearfund, and Lisa McEwen from AUT.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you all enjoyed the show. And thank you to Casper for taking the reins on this one. I'll be handing you over very shortly to Jin, who will take you through to 4 o'clock. Stay tuned, you're on The Bee.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.